Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Making Sense with Steve Laser.
Y'all ready for this?
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, fellow liberals and Democrats, inquisitive Republicans, and concerned citizens of all backgrounds. Welcome to Making Sense with Steve Laser, the show that breaks down the top issues in the last week in politics, strips out all the nonsense, and provides you the best analysis in political media. Welcome aboard, and let's get to work. Our format for this week's show will be a little different. I'm going to go briefly through a number of the top pieces of news for the week, and then we have a very special interview with Sari Singer. Ansari was a witness to one terrorist attack and the victim of another, and now runs an organization that seeks to help victims of terror cope with the aftermath of their experiences. If you want to write to me and give me your opinion of any topic I cover, write to makingsenseletters@yahoo.com, and I may just read your opinion on the air. Again, that's makingsenseletters@yahoo.com. So we'll get started right after this.
Do you know our sense of smell is the most important after our sense of sight? It's the most powerful as well, and it triggers memories and emotions, and is the most compelling aspect to make you feel wonderful. At scentaprises.com, that's scenterprises.com, we take you on a fragrance journey to learn about the magic and mystery of scent to create your very own custom perfume. We have an exquisite range of perfume blends which spans the entire fragrance palette, from sparkling citrus notes to light, fresh, and clean herbals and marine notes. Florals that everyone will love, such as fresh, gentle, sexy, and heady florientals. And if you prefer sophisticated fragrances, our blends of spicy, amber, woodsy, musky, mossy, and luscious gourmand vanilla notes are warm, sensual, and combine beautifully with all the blends. So why wear what everyone else wears when you can create your very own custom perfume? Be different. Contact Sue at scentaprises.com. Scentaprises, our business makes you sensational.
A Florida jury returned a not guilty verdict for George Zimmerman in the Trayvon Martin case. I agree with New York City mayoral candidate Bill Thompson, who tweeted, quote, "Trayvon Martin was killed because he was black," end quote. Now, my understanding is that the NAACP is asking the U.S. Department of Justice to file a federal civil rights suit, which would assert that Zimmerman's racial profiling of Trayvon Martin led to his death. That's what the Justice Department did some 20 years ago after the jury in the Rodney King beating case returned not guilty verdicts for the police officers involved. Two officers were subsequently found guilty of violating King's civil rights, and the court sentenced them to nearly 3 years in prison for beating King. Now, I hope the Justice Department files civil rights charges. I personally can't get over the fact that a 17-year-old kid walking through his father's neighborhood minding his own business and drinking iced tea and Skittles was followed and ultimately killed because a middle-aged police officer wannabe thought he didn't belong there because he was black. Next, we have Benghazi, also known as the scandal that looks like it will end in the resignation of Virginia's Republican Governor Bob McDonnell. NBC News reported on Friday that multiple sources in Richmond's legal community have confirmed that the investigation of Star Scientific by state and federal prosecutors has turned up what they feel is sufficient evidence to charge Virginia's Republican Governor Bob McDonnell and his wife Maureen with one or more felonies. And in consequence, Mr. McDonnell is attempting to negotiate his resignation in exchange for no prosecution of Virginia's first couple. If you're not familiar with the Virginia Giftgate scandal, or Benghazi as I call it, a prominent political donor purchased a Rolex watch for Governor McDonnell, according to two people with knowledge of the gift, and the governor did not disclose it in his annual financial filings. The watch was provided by wealthy businessman Johnny Williams Sr. He's the chief executive of dietary supplement manufacturer Star Scientific and the person who paid for catering at the wedding of the governor's daughter. His gift came in 2011, about 2 weeks after he met with a top state health official to pitch the benefits of his company's health products at a meeting arranged by First Lady Maureen McDonald, who encouraged Williams to buy the Rolex for the governor. Apparently, the first couple thought that they could get away with blatant influence peddling and pay for play, or at least Rolex bling for pay. They were wrong. As I've been reporting, immigration reform seems to be dead in the House. After the Senate passed landmark immigration reform bill, complete with strict border control, and President Obama promised to sign it, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives says that they will not even consider the Senate's bill because they think the border control isn't strict enough and because they oppose the path to citizenship, which they call an amnesty bill. The GOP-controlled House is looking more and more like it will not pass anything recognizable as immigration reform. Huffington Post reports that South Carolina's Governor Nikki Haley is taking heat after an investigation by the state law enforcement division shows that virtually no voter fraud is happening in South Carolina. Republicans across the country are always claiming that voter fraud is happening that benefits Democrats. A multi-year investigation by the Bush administration failed to find significant voter fraud nationally, and now a state investigation by a Republican governor has come up with the same result. How much do you want to guess or bet that this has no impact on the claims by Republicans and voter fraud accusations continue as before? We'll be right back. What's the biggest fallacy about diamonds? More facets are better and will create more fire. Doesn't that make sense? Nothing could be farther from the truth. In fact, larger facets create more fire. The new Blaze Cut is a unique square diamond with a fabulous display of colors never before seen emanating from a diamond. In fact, the Blaze Diamond has 9 times the fire of any other round diamond of the same size. It took a genius to invent the Blaze Diamond, and an amazing artist to highlight the beauty in fine jewelry. View Blaze Diamond Jewelry by Bez Ambar on Badler.com, BADLER.com, or search Blaze Diamond on YouTube to see remarkable videos. Experience this new innovation by coming to Maurice Badler Fine Jewelry in New York City, 485 Park Avenue between 58th and 59th Streets. Visit Badler.com for more information or call 800-M-BADLER. That's 800-M-B-A-D-L-E-R. I'd like to tell you all about my special guest, Sari Singer. Until 9/11, Sari worked 2 blocks away from the World Trade Center. But she overslept that morning and so wasn't at work when the attacks came. But she watched them from her apartment in Manhattan. In December 2001, after that experience, she decided to move to Israel to help victims of terror. On June 11, 2003, just a little over 10 years ago, Sari was on bus 14 in Jerusalem when an 18-year-old Palestinian terrorist dressed as a religious Jew boarded and blew himself up. 16 people were killed, including all those seated and standing around her. And over 100 people were injured in what became known as the Davidka Square bus bombings. Sari was hospitalized for almost 2 weeks and then returned to New Jersey to be with her family. Her story of being so intimately involved with 2 major terror attacks has become very high profile, and she was asked to tell her story on networks like CBS, Fox News, CNN, and various radio shows like Making Sense. Sari is the founder and director of Strength to Strength, www.stosglobal.org. Again, that's www.stosglobal.org. And it focuses on bringing together victims of terrorism together from around the world and assisting with long-term psychological needs. Sari has addressed audiences throughout the United States, Canada, Europe, and Israel, and continues to share her unique insight into the ongoing struggle for victims of terror in Israel and around the world. So, Sari, welcome to Making Sense.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's definitely our pleasure. And your story is so incredible. You've seen the face of terror close up and personal like few other people have seen it, first as a witness and then as a victim. Tell us about the Davidka Square bombing. What's your recollection of that event?
So I actually remember the day as if it was yesterday. I was awake the whole time, so the details, even though I couldn't see anything, I still remember everything. I was on my way to meet a friend for dinner in Jerusalem in an area called the German Colony, where there are lots of restaurants and a residential area, and a lot of Americans and Anglos frequent there often, including tourists. And we were meeting at a restaurant called Cafe Hillel for dinner, and I wasn't sure what bus to take from my office because I never really took a bus to that area because I lived so close by. So I used to walk there. So I called my friend to ask her what bus to take, and she said, I can catch the number 14 after the central bus station. And so probably around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I made my way on the first bus that I was taking to the central bus station. I got off, and then I walked to the bus stop waiting for the number 14. It was close to the end of the day. People were already coming out to the bus stops to go home, and people get very antsy at the end of the day when the buses are running late, and I sort of started to feed into that antsiness of, like, why is the bus late? I really want to get to where I need to go. And the reason why I was taking the bus and not a cab was because I had actually taken cabs that morning to different meetings, and I didn't have any cash left on me. So I figured I would take the bus because I had a bus pass. But when the bus was running late, I decided, let me hail a cab, and I'll stop at an ATM. As we enter the German colony, I'll get money out so I could pay the cab driver. And as I went to hail the cab, I saw the bus 14 come, and I thought, okay, it's meant for me to get on the bus.
Wow.
And as I boarded the bus, I called my friend to tell her where I was so she'd know how far away and when I would arrive. There were no empty seats when I boarded the bus. It was pretty packed. So I was standing by the back door, which is really the middle of the bus. It's right behind the front section of the bus. And as we started to the next bus stop, which was Machane Yehuda, the marketplace, I saw two seats open up in the front section, and I decided to sit down. And normally I would have taken the aisle seat because at this market, everyone gets on with a lot of packages, and I would have wanted to get up for somebody who might have been older with a lot of packages coming on. But for some reason on that day, I moved into the window seat, and I remember the girl who sat down next to me and her boyfriend was standing. And I know that if I didn't take that window seat, I wouldn't be here today. We started to move away from the marketplace. The bus started going. And I remember not even thinking twice about anything. The bus stop was packed. It wasn't a bus stop only for one bus number. There were probably at least 10 bus numbers within that area. So there were hundreds of people trying to get on the buses and pushing their way to get on. So you didn't differentiate between anybody outside because there were just hundreds of people there. And it was a packed place, especially at the end of the day. So as we departed, I remember just like glancing outside but not really thinking twice about anything. I went to put my phone in my knapsack, and as I was looking down to put it away because I'd just gotten a phone with my friend, I felt a huge shockwave hit my face. And the only way to explain to you what the shockwave feels like, it's like two pieces of metal that hit so hard against each other and vibrate back. That's what I remember my face feeling like. And I remember my face and my body were being pushed back. The shockwave was pushing them against the back of the seat, and I remember trying to lift my hands up to my face, and my hands were being pulled down. And when the blast stopped, I couldn't open my left eye at all because something had hit it from the bus already, and it was swollen shut. And my right eye, I could barely open just enough to see the roof of the bus had fallen in, and the man's head in front of me, and he wasn't moving. And right after the blast, and I remember other victims that I had worked with before this sharing with me their stories. So when the blast stops, for a split second, there's this silence. And it's not the silence in the summertime when the crickets are out in the country. It's literally a split second, but it's the silence of death all around you. And it feels like more than a second, but that's really all it is. And then after that silence, my ears started ringing really, really loud, and I started screaming. And luckily, I was screaming because there was a guy outside who heard me. He had been three blocks away. He heard something, and he came running to help. And he and another man pulled me out of the bus and brought me to the side of the road where an old woman waited with me and started asking me questions to try and keep me awake before I was put into the ambulance. For me, the experience was very, very fast. For some victims, it feels like help takes a lot of time, but I think the fact that I was screaming and they knew that I was there, that they were able to get me out quickly. I was taken to Hadassah Hospital. My injuries for Israel were considered kal, which means lightly injured, but for American standards, it definitely wasn't lightly injured. Lightly injured means that you're not missing a limb. And I had shrapnel that went through my left shoulder, breaking my clavicle bone. I had both my eardrums blown from the impact of the blast. I have two pieces of shrapnel in my mouth that are inoperable. My legs were badly cut up from metal from the bus. My hair was burned. My face was burned and bleeding. And that's lucky because, unfortunately, some people come out of these things with missing limbs and some people don't come out at all. And I spent time the first night in Hadassah, waiting to go into surgery. They assessed me and said that I was the last person to go into surgery that evening because I was the least of the seriously wounded.
Wow.
So I was in the hospital waiting until I think I went into surgery around 11 or 11:30 that evening.
Amazing. So one of the things that struck me as you were telling your story is all of the sort of events that had to come together for you to be there. So you were waiting 10 minutes. You almost had gotten a cab. You were standing in the back. Two seats became available. You know, just slight modifications to the things that happened, and things you either would have missed the bombing completely, or you wouldn't have survived. It's
absolutely. I think about those things all the time. In a sense that, you know, the decisions I made that day saved my life. I rarely took the window seats, and for some reason I moved in. You know, and after knowing that the girl next to me didn't survive, the people in the two rows in front of me didn't survive, the people that were standing, they said that the terrorist was approximately two people away from where I was seated based on the impact of those in the front section of the bus that were murdered.
Now, you used a very interesting word there that I want to talk about just a little bit. You used the word murdered. You didn't use the word killed or attacked or any of those euphemisms that I think that people in the media typically use with regard to terrorist attacks. Tell us about that. You consider it all the people who died and the people who always die in terrorist attacks. You feel that's murder.
Absolutely. A terrorist attack is a planned and calculated attack to hurt and murder innocent people for political gain. And for me, the ends don't justify the means, and there's no justification for anybody deciding that they have the right to go out there and to hurt and murder innocent civilians.
Okay.
These are people getting on a bus to go home from work. Young children were on the bus. This is not people that were fighting with anybody. These are people just going home to their families, and some of them didn't make it that day. And the wording is so important to me. The wording to say a terrorist attack doesn't happen and people are killed. People are murdered. That's what happens. Terrorism destroys lives. And I think sometimes people don't realize that the long-term effects for victims and their family members. You know, we forget sometimes that even though somebody might have survived or they they're okay, their family members are directly impacted and sometimes traumatized more than they are. And so I use the word murder because I think it's really important for people to understand the seriousness of how I feel and how passionate I am about realizing that a terrorist attack isn't something that's accidental. It's planned. It's calculated. It's to destroy people because it doesn't matter. I mean, every attack, you know, some people are injured and some people are murdered. But that terrorist goal is to murder everybody that's within that area of the blast. His goal is not to just injure. His goal is to murder. And what happened 10 years ago to me was a day that somebody tried to murder me for no reason other than I was on a bus and I was in a place that he felt I shouldn't be.
You know, along these lines, one of the things that I wanted to ask you, do you feel that the experience that you've gone through has influenced your perception of the possibility and desirability of peace between Israel and the Palestinians? I have a feeling I know the answer to this question, but has it influenced that, and if so, how?
I think that, in an ideal world, there would be peace. I really believe that the only way to peace is when the next generation is educated not to hate. I think education is the key in combating terrorism. So as much as everyone talks about, and I do believe that this two-state solution is the solution, but I also am concerned about that two-state solution actually happening based on previous history. You know, history has a tendency to repeat itself, and what we've seen in the past in terms of, and I happen to have, you know, educated myself in terms of some of the stuff that went on with Oslo and Camp David and all the agreements that happened in the past, and it just seems to show me that until the next generation's educated, peace can't exist the right way. We have to educate and help people to love and to show kindness instead of the hate that's perpetuating throughout the Middle East. And I don't only think that's with the Palestinians and the Israelis. Look what's going on in the other areas, in Syria. And I mean, it's insane what's going on there. People are doing things that I can't even think about. But it's because they're educated in the wrong way. And I think that the world has a responsibility to take on this mission to educate the next generation not to hate. When there are camps going on in the summer in Gaza teaching young children that the ultimate thing for them to do is to become a martyr and to sacrifice and murder themselves for a greater cause, that to me is the problem. When you see television shows that these children are watching, kids shows where they have like these people dressed up as Mickey Mouse and other things telling them to be a martyr. These are the things that are putting them in the position to perpetuate this cycle of terrorism. And we have to stop that. We need to educate these young children and let them know that there's another way for them. But they're not being educated within that direction. So I really believe that that's the solution, but I don't see it in the near future. I'd like to. I think everybody wants peace in Israel. People don't want to live like that. Too many lives have been taken. Thousands of Israelis have been impacted by terrorism there, and thousands of people around the world have been impacted by terrorism. And we really have to figure a way to combat this hate, and I think that education is really the key.
What do you say to people who say that the fact that Israel hasn't given full determination to the Palestinians is one of the greatest contributors to people in the Middle East and that region of the world being angry and wanting to commit terrorism?
So I'm not a Middle East expert. From my personal experiences within this, I feel that it's just not true. And I think that people really need to do their research and understand what's going on in the Middle East. And I always suggest to people to read some of the Palestinian journalists. I've always suggested Joseph Farah is an amazing journalist who writes about the myth behind the Middle East and discusses the fact of what's really going on within the Palestinians and what needs to really happen. And I think that, you know, you don't always believe everything you read in the media and what's written, and I just don't think it's all that clear, and it's not a black and white situation. There's more to it than people realize. And sometimes I feel like people don't always have to give their opinion about everything going on there. You know, there are people in the country, in Israel, that are in the government that are doing the best they can to protect their citizens, and that should be the most important thing. It's the only democratic country there. So how can you think that they're doing something wrong when they're a democracy and the other places are not? I mean, there has to be a lot of change in the Middle East, and I don't think anybody wants to come forward and help with that change. They just think that if they solve the Israel-Palestinian conflict, then everything else is going to work out, and I don't think that that's really the reality.
Okay, so let's go in a slightly different direction and get away from the politics here for a moment. You recently went back to celebrate the 10th anniversary of your surviving the bombings. You went back to Davidka and you took mass transit there. What was that like?
So I actually, the last time, last summer when I was in Israel in 2012, I was there in July, but I really didn't go back to the site of the attack. I made a decision literally 3 hours before I left the country last year with some encouragement that I was going to go back on a bus for the first time in 9 years, which was very intense. And the number 14 bus doesn't run down the same route anymore because there's now a train down the route where the bus went 10 years ago. So I decided to go on a bus that was going on the route as if I was going to where I was supposed to be that day 9 years before. And so I did make on the bus 2 stops. It was very, very difficult and very hard, but I thought it was something that was really important. When I returned to Israel this year, the anticipation and the I want to say the anxiety of whether or not I was going to go back on a bus was really huge, because when I went on the bus the year before, I felt that the second I stepped off that bus after the second stop, I stepped off and I felt like I won.
That really is a victory over terror. And speaking of terror and people who engage in it, I know I said we were going to get off politics. One last thing, though, and then we'll move on to strength to strength. If you could speak directly to people around the world who might contemplate planning or engaging in a terrorist attack, what would you say to them? In other words, if you could speak directly to Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Al-Aqsa Martyr Brigades, or Hamas, or any of those folks, what would you say to them?
So I think that's a really interesting question. I've never actually been asked it before. I also find for myself and my thinking that how can you actually talk to people that are irrational and that have little value for human life? How could you even think that anything that you would say would impact them in a positive way? And it's a hard thing, because you always want to think that people can change and that there is some good, and I always try and think that there is a lot of good even through bad situations. But if I could speak to somebody, I'd probably say to them that the ends don't justify the means. What you're doing does not accomplish what you think it does, and you're murdering innocent people, and you're destroying lives. And the fact that you're doing this is not going to bring you any closer to what you think you need to accomplish. And there has to be a better way, to get to where you need to be. But at the same time, I don't think that any of my words would make any difference.
Okay. Well, that was a tough question. I think you did pretty well with it. Tell us, though, about Strength to Strength. What is it, and why did you found it?
So Strength to Strength is an organization that brings survivors of terrorism together and family members to heal with long-term psychological issues and the long-term needs of victims and their families. Our organization, half our board are either survivors of terrorist attacks or bereaved family members, and they range from different countries. We have a survivor from 9/11. We have a survivor from Mumbai, a bereaved family member from Ireland. So we are global in a sense that the idea is that terrorism is not one country's problem, it's a world problem, and we all have to come together to combat the hate that we've experienced and show the opposite of what that day was all about, showing love and kindness to others. We work with existing organizations in various countries around the world that are working on the ground with victims and their families to bring survivors together with the motto of survivors healing survivors. We found that, we have, when we're in a room with people that understand what we've been through, that's the best type of therapy for us, to know that we can talk to people that understand what we've been through and to talk about things that we're currently going through that people will understand because they've had the same experiences previously. So we just came off of 3 weeks ago, we just came off of our Young Ambassadors program, where we bring young people ages 14 to 20 who've either lost a family member in a terrorist attack or been injured themselves. They come for a week to New York City. I will say that most of the staff, with the exception of our trauma specialists that join us for the week, most of the staff are also either survivors or bereaved family members. So the young people are not only meeting peers that have been through what they've been through, but they're also meeting role models of adults who have gone through what they've been through and hopefully are a support system for them. They spend a week touring. They share their stories with each other, and they also share their stories with community and political leaders in order to empower them to go back to their countries and to move forward with their lives and to do something great and not to think that they can't make a difference. And we've just seen the results of this program in terms of the young people really understanding that they can still move forward and not forget about their loved ones, or they can move forward even though they've been injured. This past program, we had young people from Ireland, from England, Spain, Algeria, Israel, Argentina, and the United States. And it was at the beginning of the week, nobody knows each other, and by the end of the week, you would think that the young people know each other for 10 years plus. And they've now built a global peer support group where they have people that they can rely on and that they can count on, that if there's something wrong, they know that they have somebody to talk to. And I think that's really key for a lot of these young people, to know that they're not alone and that they have a place that they can go to, that they can talk to anybody that they might know, that can understand. And I just actually received an email recently from one of the participants, and she said to me that she wanted to thank us for the amazing week in New York, and it was definitely the best week of her life. She knew that she can pull through her dark days and know that she have people to talk to, and she's thankful that she has a whole new group of friends that she can now call family. And she just thanked Strength to Strength for taking us young people to New York to teach us that we each have each other and people all around the world that have gone through what her and her family have been through. And she can't wait to meet everybody again and for the experience that she had. And unfortunately, she lost her brother in a terrorist attack in 1998 in the Alma bombing. And it definitely impacted her very, very deeply. And it impacts families. We don't realize, you know, when somebody loses a child, sometimes the parents aren't able to take care of themselves. And so the siblings who are also going through trauma are left to, you know, be passed around to different family members. And so they don't have any stability in their life. And that affects them also because nobody might be talking about what happened either. So there's lots of different things that affect families in different ways that I think the general public doesn't really understand. What we do is we give these, not only the young victims, but the older victims we work with, a voice. That they know that they need to talk about their experiences and share them so that other people will understand what they've been through. And our goal is really just to help victims move forward and to make sure that the next generation is not traumatized from what their parents or whatever the current generation is going through. And that's a lot of what the Young Ambassadors Program is all about, to make sure that these next generation of future leaders of their countries are able to make a difference and not let the trauma of terrorism destroy their future.
And what symptoms do these folks normally present? Is it PTSD like you would expect from other types of trauma? And also, you mentioned that you have trauma specialists. Are they board-certified psychiatrists or people trained to do therapy, things like that? Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Our advisory board consists of people that are trained and that are accredited, and the chair of our advisory board is Dr. David Pelkovitz, who's a known psychologist and has worked with trauma and PTSD, and especially his specialty is children. Another one of our advisory board members is Dr. Michelle Perlman, who headed up the NYU Trauma and Resilience Center at NYU after 9/11. One of our board members, Paulo Pimentel, is a trauma specialist, and he was commissioned by the mayor of London to set up, at that time, the 7th of July Assistance Center to work with all the families from the London bombings and 12 other previous attacks that had happened in England. So these people really are the top of you know, knowing what they're doing. Dr. Danny Brom, who's at the Israel Center for Psychotrauma, who deals regularly with the families from attacks in Israel, is on our advisory board. We've really picked people who have experience. Maria Lozano is from Spain. She heads up the largest organization in Spain working with victims from the Madrid bombings. So we've selected and have involved with us people that really understand and work with the families directly in these countries, as well as the victims themselves that have started organizations to help other families in their community. So we try very hard to reach out, you know, to trauma specialists, anyone who's interested in working with us and wanting to help with some of the families or even some of our groups. We have a survivor circle that we run, and sometimes we have trauma specialists that will facilitate them. We really want people to be engaged and be involved in helping with long-term needs. And so because we're all volunteer-based, anybody who wants to be involved in helping us, we're so happy for the assistance.
So it sounds like you've got the right staff and the right experts. How can people listening to this get involved? Should they go to the website, www.stosglobal.org? What kinds of things can people do if they want to volunteer or get more information? Is there a number?
They can go to the website. They can call us at 877-432-7811. They can email us from the website and let us know that they're interested in getting involved. We always have volunteer and internship opportunities. We look for people to help us we have a new young executives division that we just started 2 months ago, and they made such an impact on these young people. Here we had young professionals in the New York area picking up these young people and meeting them at the airport and making them feel so loved. And that love from strangers turns into this empowerment that these kids go home with. And so we had a lot of young professionals spending time with the group. We took them to Dave & Buster's one night, and some of our young leadership came out and helped us and spent time playing with them, video games. It's a lot of really knowing that people around the world care about what you're going through and just want to be there as support for you. That goes a long way with victims and of terrorism.
Okay, great. Sari Singer, co-founder of Strength to Strength, victim of one terrorist attack, witness to another, and dedicated to helping the victims of terror. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Take care.
Do you know our sense of smell is the most important after our sense of sight? It's the most powerful as well, and it triggers memories and emotions, and is the most compelling aspect to make you feel wonderful. At scentreprises.com, that's scenterprises.com, we take you on a fragrance journey to learn about the magic and mystery of scent to create your very own custom perfume. We have an exquisite range of perfume blends which spans the entire fragrance palette, from sparkling citrus notes to light, fresh, and clean herbals and marine notes, florals that everyone will love, such as fresh, gentle, sexy, and heady florientals. And if you prefer sophisticated fragrances, our blends of spicy, amber, woodsy, musky, mossy, and luscious gourmand vanilla notes are warm, sensual, and combine beautifully with all the blends. So why wear what everyone else wears when you can create your very own custom perfume? Be different. Contact Sue at scentreprises.com. Scentreprises, our business makes you sensational.
Blinded by the light.
And now it's time for our weekly Hall of Fame and Shame for those politicians and prominent individuals who made great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. First, our Hall of Fame for making sense. Winning the Hall of Fame this week for making great sense is Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. Before I get into why Harry Reid won the Hall of Fame, let me just say that the award is contingent on him following through on the threat that I will describe shortly. You see, in January of this year, Democrats in the Senate were discussing radical changes to the ability to mount a filibuster. This was being discussed because of the rampant abuse of the filibuster by Republicans since Democrats retook the Senate. Before Democrats retook the Senate, the most cloture that had been voted on to end a filibuster during a single Senate session was 49. That was, coincidentally, during the first few years of the Clinton administration. Well, right after the Democrats retook the Senate, Republicans mounted so many filibusters that 112 votes on cloture were required to try and overcome them. By the beginning of 2013, Democrats had had enough. Majority Leader Reid announced that radical changes to filibuster rules would be enacted by the new Senate. But last-minute negotiations were had, including promises by Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell not to use the filibuster to obstruct administration nominees. Despite those promises, Republicans have continued to abuse the filibuster and refused to allow up and down votes on many administration nominees and judicial appointments. So this past week, Senator Harry Reid has announced that the so-called nuclear option is on the table. And privately, Reid apologized to the Democratic Senate caucus for believing Mitch McConnell and announced that he has met with the president, who agreed that it might be time to use the nuclear option or other more radical filibuster reform measures. Now, the nuclear option, described in a 2005 article in the Washington Post by Mike Allen and Jeffrey Birnbaum, refers to an idea floated by then-Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, wherein the vice president, acting in his capacity as president of the Senate, would rule from the chair that a filibuster on judicial nominees was inconsistent with the constitutional grant of power to the president to name judges with the advice and consent of the Senate. And that would be interpreting advice and consent of the Senate to mean consent of a simple majority of senators, not consent under the Senate rules. The effect of that would be that judicial nominees would constitutionally not be allowed to be filibustered by the Senate. Now, there are other options that Reid could invoke, including doing away with the filibuster in its entirety, or requiring a filibuster to be a true talking filibuster, similar to what Wendy Davis recently did in the Texas Senate. You want a filibuster? You've got to stand up and you've got to keep talking. The moment that you stop talking, your filibuster fails. I think that's fair. Discussing the reasons why he might make a radical change to the filibuster rules, Majority Leader Reid had this to say.
The gridlock Republicans have created is not only bad for President Obama and bad for the Senate, it's bad for this country. Now, Mr. President, we can have people come here and give you all the statistics in the world. Is there anybody out there in America that thinks this body is functioning well?
Now, Senator Reid is right here, and he needs to go ahead and make the change. McConnell has already shown that he's not trustworthy, so any further negotiation or deals with him wouldn't be worth anything. He just would go back on his word again. So congratulations to Democratic Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for winning this week's Hall of Fame for making great sense. Senator Reid, you got to follow through, though, guy. You'll lose a lot of credibility on both sides of the aisle if you fail to enact some pretty serious filibuster reform. I said at the beginning of this piece, if Reid doesn't follow through, you might see him in the Hall of Shame in short order. Speaking of which, now we have our Hall of Shame this week for those politicians and prominent individuals who made shameful nonsense.
All aboard!
In third place this week in our Hall of Shame, we have Pennsylvania's Republican Governor Tom Corbett. Republicans, you know, they've got this odd problem with low-income people having access to health care. Now, I know that some Republicans would probably respond to that by saying they only have a problem with government-subsidized or government-paid-for health care. Well, Republicans, that doesn't work, because many folks in low-income jobs don't have an employer-offered health insurance plan. And for a low-income person, buying your own health care, it's impossible. It's prohibitively expensive. I mean, it's prohibitively expensive for even most middle-class Americans to try and foot the entire bill for a health insurance plan. So low-income Americans have no chance of being able to pay for their own. So Republicans attacking Medicaid is basically saying that low-income Americans should not be able to have health insurance coverage. They shouldn't be able to go to the doctor. They shouldn't be able to get care from a specialist. Reading between the lines, that's what Republicans are really saying. The Affordable Care Act, commonly referred to as Obamacare, will make a lot more low-income Americans eligible for Medicaid starting in January of 2014, and Republicans just can't stand it. The latest Republican to complain about poor people being able to get good quality health care is Pennsylvania's Republican Governor Tom Corbett. Let's listen.
What I hear all the time coming out of the administration in Washington is it's the working poor. Yes, it is working, but you should be investing $5, $10 in copay to understand that when you go to the hospital or the doctors, you just can't keep going and going and going and think everything's going to be covered. You have to know that, you know, you have some interest in what's going on.
What Corbett said here is designed to make a heartless and disgusting objection sound palatable. Here's what you need to understand. If you have a family of four, and that family has income over $31,000 a year, that family would not qualify for Medicaid under the new provisions. Talking about individuals, an individual that makes over about $15,000 a year also would not qualify. So we're talking about people who are making very little money. They're earning money, they're just making very little money. They can't afford copays, Governor Corbett. Not only that, they can't afford to miss a whole lot of work to supposedly abuse going to the doctor. I'm not sure how familiar many of you are with low-income jobs and the benefits they offer, but the kinds of jobs that pay the amount of money that we're talking about, they don't have what you would call generous vacation and sick pay benefits. When you put it into context, this objection by Governor Corbett is complete nonsense. And he knows it. And it wins him third place this week in our Hall of Shame for worst nonsense of the week. In second place for even worse nonsense this week, we have Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Republican attempts to demagogue and use hyperbole often sound ridiculous, and Think Progress reported on a Mitch McConnell rant about a Republican proposal to pass a constitutional amendment requiring a balanced federal budget. Now, the rant itself is ridiculous without knowing the details of the issues and the budget, but when you consider the full details, it gets even worse. First, let's play what Senator McConnell said.
The time has come for a balanced budget amendment that forces Washington to balance its books. If these debt negotiations have convinced us of anything, it's that we can't leave it to politicians in Washington to make the difficult decisions they need to get our fiscal house in order. The balanced budget amendment will do that for them. Now is the moment. No more games, no more gimmicks. The Constitution must be amended to keep the government in check. We've tried persuasion, we've tried negotiations, we've tried elections. Nothing has worked.
So elections are bad now, and the Constitution's insufficient. Well played, Mr. McConnell, well played. Of course, that's just the beginning of the irony and the nonsense here. Let's start with the fact that if we experience some sort of national catastrophe, a balanced budget amendment could very well eliminate the government's ability to deal with that catastrophe. Also, how about the fact that Republican Ronald Reagan is the president that started the modern practice of massive deficit spending? Before Reagan, all the post-World War II budgets were pretty close to being balanced, if not in fact being balanced or surplus producing. Finally, how about the fact that under President Obama, we now have a budget deficit that is shrinking by substantial numbers? The only time that happened since 1980 is under Democratic administrations. So elections do in fact matter, Mr. McConnell. Elections that result in a Democratic president being in office result in the budget deficit eventually being lowered or eliminated entirely. And elections that resulted in Republicans becoming president have universally resulted in explosive annual deficits, and those results were the case in every presidential election since 1980, or nine presidential elections. It takes a lot of talent to be as wrong as Mitch McConnell is here. And he's runner-up this week in our Hall of Shame for infamous nonsense. The award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week goes to former Republican senator and now president of the Heritage Foundation, Jim DeMint. Hardly a week goes by where Republicans fail to demonstrate that they have an ongoing war on women and the LGBT community. As long as they keep those trashing on those groups and their rights, I'm going to keep reporting it either in the regular segments or here in the Hall of Shame. I meant to have Jim DeMint win the Hall of Shame last week, and as a result of an error, I missed putting him in. But the two things that he said that were going to get him into last week's Hall of Shame were bad enough where he deserves to win this week, even though his statements are now 10 to 14 days old. One of the things that he said was an ugly attack on women. And another, as I said, was an ugly attack on the LGBT community. Let's first listen to his attack on women. Listen to what he insinuates here and how Rachel Maddow takes issue with it.
Well, David, cases like the Philadelphia abortionist Kermit Gosnell,
yeah,
that shows the horrendous conditions in these clinics that have actually killed women. I mean, if we're talking about women's health, we need to consider that. But now two-thirds of Americans believe that after a baby's heart is beating and they can feel pain, that they need some protection. So I'm glad to see a lot of states like Texas and Arkansas begin to consider this. And the more the ultrasounds have become part of the law where a woman gets the opportunity to see that there's a real child, it's beginning to change minds. And I think that's a good thing. It's time that the 3,000 babies we lose every day have some people speaking up for them. She's forgetting about the thousands of women who want an informed choice, who want the opportunity to get a free ultrasound, which they can get not from Planned Parenthood, but from a lot of these pregnancy centers.
Right.
It is free in many cases, all the ones I'm familiar with.
Just a few seconds.
How do people like this get elected to the U.S. Senate? Well, DeMint isn't in the Senate anymore, of course, but how did he get there in the first place? The insinuation that women have a choice in what Republicans intend for them is not true. These ultrasounds are not a choice, and in many situations, as Maddow notes, they're not free. Women have to pay for these mandatory ultrasounds that are not necessary for what the women want, which is an abortion. What DeMint said is untrue enough to be considered a bald-faced lie. And the suggestion that conditions are bad in abortion clinics because of a one-off in one doctor's office, that's also extremely misleading. In fact, more women die and have complications from childbirth than from abortion. So if the health of the woman is a consideration, abortion should be available on demand. The illogical gyrations Republicans go through on this issue are really discrediting. You know, as important as I think it is for women to have this right, I can respect an opposing view on this if it's not drowning in lies. Just say, I find this morally wrong. All of these lies and misleading statements and attempts to force women to have and in most cases pay for unnecessary invasive additions to procedures just confirms that Republicans have no respect at all for women and their rights. DeMint then made it a twofer by suggesting that the Supreme Court's decision to strike down part of the Defense of Marriage Act is bad for children and that it's good to discriminate against lesbians and gays. Maddow also took him to task on that. Let's listen.
Say, David, is he is denying dignity to the millions of Americans who, for moral or religious reasons, believe that gay marriage is wrong. As you just said, you've got 37 states where the people have decided that they want to protect the marriage between a man and a woman because they know that that's the environment where children can thrive and succeed. I mean, that's been proven. So it's not about the desires of adults. It's really about the best environment for children. We're talking all about politics. But the reason governments at the state level, the federal level, have recognized marriage between a man and a woman is because it's better for our country and it's better for children.
Justice Kennedy addressed that issue specifically in his role.
He talked about children as well.
He says that by denying marriage rights to same-sex couples who have kids, you're humiliating and demeaning those kids by denying their families equal protection under the law by the parents who are raising them and who love them and who make their family. So we can put it in the interest of children, but I think that cuts both ways, and I think the ruling cuts against that argument. I mean, gay people exist. There's nothing we can do in public policy that makes more of us exist or less of us exist. And you guys have been arguing for a generation that public policy ought to essentially demean gay people as a way of expressing disapproval of the fact that we exist. But you don't make any less of us exist. You just are arguing in favor of discrimination. More discrimination doesn't make straight people's lives any better.
More discrimination against gay people doesn't make the lives of straight people better. So true, Rachel. It's the same thing with any kind of discrimination. It doesn't make your life better to try and prevent other people from having equality. And as far as the canard about the children, the few independent studies that have been done show that children do just as well with gay parents as with straight parents. An example of this is the study co-authored by two medical doctors and professors of pediatrics, Benjamin Siegel and Ellen Perrin from Boston University. And their study was published by the American Academy of Pediatrics. Doctors Perrin and Siegel note that many studies have demonstrated that children's well-being is affected much more by their relationships with their parents' sense of competence and security, and the presence of social and economic support for the family than by gender or the sexual orientation of their parents. After taking readers through all of their sources and over 60 citations worth of material, Perrin and Siegel conclude that on the basis of this comprehensive review of the literature regarding the development and adjustment of children whose parents are the same gender, as well as the existing evidence for the legal, social, and health benefits of marriage to children, the American Academy of Pediatrics concludes that it is in the best interest of children that they be able to partake in the security of permanent nurturing and care that comes with the civil marriage of their parents, without regard to their parents' gender or sexual orientation. Again, Mr. DeMint, that's the American Academy of Pediatrics saying that. So that attempt to hide behind the think of the children appeal to emotion, well, it's disproven by the facts. The only thing left is your pathetic attempt to promote bigotry. Jim DeMint's awful Daily Double, discriminating against both women and the LGBT community, wins the award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week. That's all I have for today's show. Thank you for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser will air live 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio this Sunday, July 21st, and Monday, July 22nd at 2 p.m. Pacific Time on KCAA Radio, 1050 a.m. in Inland Empire, California. Be sure to follow me and the show on Twitter at Stephen Laser, on Facebook at Making Sense with Steve Laser, and on my blog at stevelaser.blogspot.com. Until next time, have a great rest of your day, and a great week.